Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Text Message, the light-hearted technology podcast, with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And we're joined by a very special guest who I can only describe as being like a brother to me. His name is Andrew Langson of CNET. Hello, Andy.
Hey. Thank you for having me.
That's my pleasure for the most part. It's been quite some time since you've been on the show, and I thought it was about time to rectify what I know you would describe as a mistake.
Absolutely, yeah. It's I've been plotting my return, and maybe eventual takeover, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Well, it's three of us this week. Bit of a change in format, which is good, but hopefully everyone is approving of this. I wanted to start before we get into some interesting news that Ian has prepared. I've had a little bee in my bonnet recently about email signatures. Because I've noticed a slight downward trend in one thing concerning email signatures, which is that far fewer people seem to want me to think before printing an email. And that's something that used to bug the heck out of me, because I thought, well, I'll print an email if I want to. I don't need your permission to think about checking whether I should think before printing that email.
Yeah, but I mean, who doesn't think? Like, no one's just absentmindedly control-peeing every email, are they?
Well, this is the question. The frequency of being told, please think before you print this email, makes me think that everybody's just printing emails left, right, and centre.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever printed an email. I mean, I probably have, but not in any sort of numbers that would trouble the environment.
Andy, do you ever print emails? Do you feel you need to work with...
This? No, but I always think before I do or don't, and that's the important thing. Is it fair to say, so like in terms of in environmental things on this, like those little statements that really bug me, like that bugs me for the same reason, like, well, of course I'm going to think. And it hits me in the same place as when I read on the back of packaging when it says not yet recycled, as though
can
this
I guess?
Company...
What? Can I guess why that annoys you? Is it that it sounds like the company is passing the blame?
Yeah, it's like they're saying, well, it's not our fault that this isn't yet recycled. We're going to carry on using stuff that we're going to put in the landfill and the oceans. It's not on us to change what we're doing. It's on some other party to figure out how to recycle our nonsense. And maybe I'm overstretching this, but I read those very much in the same tone of voice, and they annoy me for very similar reasons. It's like, oh, please think. It's like, well, of course. Like, this is ridiculous. Like,
yes,
yeah, no.
It is. I'm with you on that. Kate in our live chat says, I used to work with someone who printed and filed all his emails in ring binders, which sounds like an enormous waste of everybody's time.
Yeah.
I used to date a girl whose boss refused to use email and would have an assistant print out all his emails, which he would reply to by hand, which she would then type up an email back.
I have a feeling that probably still happens quite a lot in the corporate world.
It
that
might
is
do,
so
but it's
so unnecessary.
It's just such
what
an
a
enormous
waste of time.
Yes, indeed. So I've been, speaking of wastes of time, I've been paying attention to email signatures a lot recently to try and figure out what my next thing is to annoy me. Because this, you know, promotion of thinking before one prints an email seems to have been going away somewhat, which is good. Maybe people have finally started to think before printing. But I've now noticed a very high uptick in people who include images, often ones that flash and move, in their email signatures. I've noticed more people including profile photos of themselves, and that might just be a PR thing. I'm not sure.
That could be handy for PRs, to be fair.
Exactly. Some of that might be PR thing, which I can forgive. But signatures have been getting longer. if you look at them, they are getting longer because they have disclaimers. There are data protection lines. There are obviously contact details, which is fine, I think, in an email signature. There are lots and lots of things, and they are getting longer. So while the slightly preachy nature of please think before you print has gone away, which is good, they're being replaced by things I find significantly more irksome, enough to bring up at the top of a podcast.
Well, I think that the, and I hate to say this in a negative way, but the printing thing always felt to me a bit like a bit of virtue signalling. Like we're not going to do anything about the problem of the environment because, you know, we're in a gigantic organisation that probably contributes far more harm to the environment than, say, printing an email. But we are going to pretend that we're doing something about it by putting in the minimal amount of effort, which is to discourage you from printing an email, which wouldn't discourage me from printing an email because I would only ever print an email that I needed printed.
Now, this brings me to my question around what is a good email signature? Because I don't
have a name.
Just a name. Now, do you
and maybe sign, a phone number.
Would you sign your name and then have the name appear in the signature?
Yes.
What, sign it with an actual signature?
No, as in, would you say, kind regards, Ian, and then directly below that, your signature begins, it says, Ian Morris?
No, I usually do thanks, comma, and let the signature take care of the name bit.
Ah, you're one of those. Do you read your... How do you read out a mobile phone number out of interest? What is your cadence?
It's is it four? Five?
No,
that's wrong. Yeah, it's 5-5-3-3.
Yeah, I do 5-3. Yeah, so like 07-424-363-422.
5-3-3.
Everyone ring that number?
Is the correct.
I mean, I pull that number out of my arse.
Oh, that's good.
Like a head hair. So,
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a reference to something that happened before we started recording the podcast itself. Okay, so names are fine. Email addresses, we
job title is incredibly important.
I think that's useful, yeah. It's good to because, know who someone is.
Particularly,
I think, ignore this email or is it from the CEO?
Well, exactly. And also, I think it's important, depending on context, on who is reaching out to whom. Because
Don't say that. We don't reach out around here.
All right, whatever. Okay.
contact.
Establish communication.
Or whom?
Yeah, because so from like my perspective as journalist, I'm sometimes reaching out to people or people within our company who are maybe like the news writers. They are reaching out to quite important people who will have no idea who they are and what they do, and so then having that context of this isn't some like junior staff writer that they can ignore, particularly if you're maybe emailing like politicians, etc., who like, oh, it's just some junior writer, who cares? But instead, if they are have a little bit more gravitas in their job title, that really can help.
So we've agreed that that's fine then.
Yes.
What about social media links and icons? Pictorial icons. It does,
the whole
doesn't
thing
it?
Seems unnecessary. I don't need to know what your Twitter's like.
Mm. Well, I'm looking at mine right now, and mine says, Andrew Langson, editor-at-large, CNET. Also, lead photographer, Europe, CNET, because I've insisted on having two job titles. Below that, follow me on Twitter, and then @BatteryHQ. And @BatteryHQ is a link, but there are no images. There is nothing else in there. But also, I do believe that that is against our policy because there is like a boilerplate and it includes like CNET property of Red Ventures and there's supposed to be a picture of Red Ventures and probably a little banner that has its other properties in there and I don't have it. I've just got text and it just says CNET.
That's
how
fine,
many
Adam.
Of your own achievements or your company have you managed to promote in that last 30 seconds? We've got both your job titles, the company you work for, the company that owns the company you work for. What else was there mentioned? That was quite impressive, actually.
I don't know. But then my personal one says Andrew Langson, photographer, comma, journalist. Then it's got a link to my portfolio. Mm. It hasn't got a link to my YouTube channel. You're right. I should update this.
Mm. Okay, before we move on from this, because this is a topic of conversation that has no real timely ness, other than it irked me on Friday when I was reading a couple of emails all the way to the bottom, and I thought this is something to talk about on a podcast. But the final question is attachments, and specifically photographs in attachments. I do not like it when I get emailed a photograph in an email where the JPEG basically takes up the entire width of my screen.
You don't in like in line.
That's it.
Fair enough. No, I don't like it either. I like them as attachments. But we're probably just showing our age here.
No, I think it's right. I think it's important because you don't want it ruining. Back in the day, it would have been, because like if your internet is so slow that, you know, loading like a, you know, a 12 megabyte image in line would be really difficult and slow things down, whereas now that's irrelevant, but it will look weird. And like, why would you need to, I think, is the argument. Like, what, you know, here is an image that is attached, that is the thing that you need to do. And I think this is maybe more getting into just sort of bad PR or something, but what always used to bug me was when if I got invited to an event or something and it had relevant information that was being given, like obviously the time and the location, things like that, and that was put into an image and they sent you, and then put the image in line, so you can't copy any of that information out and put it into a calendar. And when you want to put in something or someone's phone number, you can't copy it. So I think it's not so much the information that's included, but how it's done to make it actually easy to access that I often find frustrating.
It's we're getting some interesting feedback in the chat here. Ian B asks, I'm not a journalist, but I do work in IT. I print 1 to 2 pages of A4 a month. And serious question, how often do you print? That is a good question. Very, very rarely indeed.
I can't print. I can only print on a secure printer in the office. So I print almost nothing. If I'm in the office, I often print stuff because I find it very useful.
I bought a printer recently because I have to print quite a lot of stuff, but it's almost entirely returns labels for couriers because most of what I do involves product coverage and loan equipment. So, you know, it's always a DHL thing that needs returning, which is, you know, I think becoming less of a thing these days because often they can bring their own labels, but for the most part, it is just easier to do yourself.
Well,
it's good, and it's easy to do. And whilst it isn't free to print, I invested in a decent laser printer because I'd just had enough. I couldn't deal with inkjet anymore. The amount of printing I did was so sporadic that all the ink ended up drying up, and it was just abysmal. So laser was the way. It's beautiful. I love my printer. I'm the only person in the whole world that can say they love their printer.
I'm sure there is a pervert somewhere who loves their printer more than you, but you're right to comment. Anyway, if you have a view on what is the correct amount of things to have in your email signature, do send it our way by email, appropriately enough. You can do that.
And we will print it out, and then we'll toss it into a seagull's mouth.
We will, yes, and then watch as it struggles to reply. And here is the Technosaurus.
Coming up on Text Message, could ad breaks in UK TV be getting longer? We'll find out after this word from our sponsor, Porg VPN. Are you looking for exotic animals to eat? Worried the Galactic Empire might see your search results? Use Porg VPN to keep your browsing history a secret. Now back to the show. Ofcom, the watchdog for UK TV broadcasting, has said that it will allow an extension, or may allow an extension, to the frequency and lengths of ad breaks, which it says will be important in improving the financial fortunes of broadcasters like ITV, STV and Channel 5. We'll find out more after these messages. Do you love peas? Do you love cheese? Then you'll love new cheesy peas from much-loved global conglomerate Industrial Chemicals Inc. Our patented long-protein fromage-flavoured mix brings delightful new taste to our specialty-designed pea substitute built from smashed soy, reconstituted into pea shapes and combined with our legally not-cheese additive. Try it now from your local diddledy-dee. Current broadcasting regulations allow an average of 7 minutes of advertising per hour, and individual breaks are not allowed to be longer than 3 minutes 50 seconds. Programmes between 21 and 44 minutes are only allowed one break. In The Guardian, an Ofcom spokesperson said, "We're scoping a range of options, but before we form any plans, we'll listen to the views and examine what TV viewers say. We need to strike the right balance between protecting viewers' interests and sustaining our traditional broadcasters, which includes helping them compete with, guess what, American streaming platforms." That argument again about competing with US streaming networks, a truly tired and predictable outcome for anything broadcasting related these days.
I must thank you for taking such great care in preparing those adverts, Ian. Great yes. care. I think it was a parody, yes?
Yes, it was. In fact, I will be pleased to congratulate anyone that can name the references that I've made to old British comedies in the adverts.
I recognised Diddly-Dee from Mitchell and Webb.
That's correct.
Now, I mean, your point is that we're basically in consultation to get more adverts and longer ones, which comes as a bit of a surprise to me, actually, because people have got less and less, I think, tolerant of interruptions, and they certainly have a much lower threshold of as far as attention spans go. This doesn't strike me as necessarily it's not the way I would have expected it to go.
I'm incredibly frustrated by it. I mean, we've got a YouTuber in the podcast this week, Andy.
Hi.
Andy, is your channel monetized?
Yes, it is monetized.
Then I have nothing more to say to you. You're part of the problem. No, I jest. I don't know if you've noticed this, but advertising on YouTube has become unbearable again. In fact, it's getting worse every minute.
I only monetize my channel through YouTube's ad revenue, so I don't also then do my own sponsorship messages or breaks to, hey, have you heard of Squarespace? If not, you are literally the last person who hasn't. But largely just because I'm not allowed to, because I'm also a journalist for CNET, so yes. I can't do anything that sort of makes me any kind of ambassador for a brand. So, but I would do, but I would find ways of making it relevant to my own audience, which I think is probably the issue with a lot of these adverts, is that what you're seeing is just 5 to 10 minutes of nonsense that spoils the overall experience.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. The thing is that I don't. No one objects to YouTubers being able to make money out of their advert breaks and that kind of thing. I just feel like one of the things that I noticed, I was watching something like a 15-minute video the other day, and I had to sit through 3 to 4 advert breaks. But even more annoying that perhaps than that was that the adverts were the same each time. It's like, guys, if I didn't get the message the first time, I'm not going to get it the second, third, and fourth time, am I? Like, I don't care about these products. Why are you pushing them to me? And stop it. You're ruining the experience. You're making me not want to use YouTube. It's counterproductive.
Yeah, we already know about the Pixel 6, so we don't need constant adverts for it on every single YouTube video. Yeah.
We're talking about YouTube, but the news is actually that this is actually around broadcast television, right? So at the moment, to recap your point, we're allowed 7 minutes of advertising per hour on average over the course of a day.
Yeah.
Individual breaks are not allowed to be longer than 3 minutes and 50 seconds. And programs between 21 and 44 minutes long are only allowed one ad break. Is there any suggestion of what the increase in length or frequency might be?
They didn't say in the article I read. I believe it would be the sort of thing where there'd be like a little consultation go on. There was also some requests, I think, from the industry had asked maybe for a relaxation of product placement rules, that there could be perhaps more or different product placement. I don't know a huge amount about product placement beyond the very basics about what's allowed and what isn't. But
none of it is allowed. I mean, elements of it are allowed on the commercial channels here, I think.
That's right, yeah. And I mean, rightly so. Because, again, though, this was billed as a way to save the industry. It was like, well, if we give them product placement, then there'll be less of an emphasis on adverts. But the fact is, that's not the way it's worked out. And product placement might be fine in a big film or a Hollywood TV series, but I just don't think it necessarily cuts the same on a small UK audience. But again, I don't think that adding more length to commercial breaks or increasing the frequency will do anything beyond annoy people. It will push people more and more to time shifting, so either recording and fast forwarding through ads, or it will, you know, just put people off the product altogether.
I completely agree. I think this is, like, the problem is people don't like watching adverts, and therefore they're finding success in using other streamers. So let's combat that problem by putting even more of the thing they hate, because we're making less money off it. It's not a good strategy. It's like websites saying, oh, we're not making as much money from ads on our front page, so let's just fill it even more so with ads, because to hell with the content. It's not a strong idea.
Ian, do you think this is a cynical move to say, well, if we annoy the customer more by increasing the number of ad breaks and the length of them, that it would push more people to subscribe to the ad-free platforms that they also run, as a way of saying, well, look, there are more ads, we need those, but if you go and subscribe to this for X pounds a month, you don't get any ads?
Yep. Yeah, it may well do. I mean, that's certainly the model that is operating with most broadcasters. ITV Hub has a premium version that's going to be turned into ITVX or something soon.
Really? That sounds like pornography.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, it may not be the final name for it, but they're working on a new version, which is much overdue, because ITV Hub is an absolute disaster and needs a ground-up redesign. I mean, iPlayer, when you think about it, has been flawless pretty much since it launched, and very rarely has any issues, and you can stream things like Ultra HD over it. Anyway, getting away from the point. Yes, I do agree with that. Like, it seems like the future model for broadcast and streaming is going to be, you can either slum it for low cost and have adverts, like Netflix is obviously going to be bringing in adverts soon, which will allow it to launch a much lower price tier, or give you maybe a discount off your choice of tier. We don't know how it's going to work yet. You know, Channel 4 has a premium paid version that drops the ads, although someone in the chat the other day was saying that apparently, even though they have that, you still do see an occasional advert, which is annoying. And then, you know, and following the US model, you know, adverts in the US have always been ridiculous. And if we go down that route where you have, you know, the cold open to a show, so the bit before the titles, then a set of adverts, then the, you know, titles for the show, then a small block of content, then another set of adverts. Yeah, it's just going to become unbearable. So maybe it will work. Maybe people will gravitate towards an ad-free platform. Maybe the answer to all this is then to launch a sort of pan-Britain kind of, pan-UK kind of service, where you get your BBC license fee included and ad-free versions of all the major broadcast networks for like 20 quid a month or something.
This is exactly what I was going to suggest. I was thinking, well, having individual, you know, if you've got it, okay, I've got to have my license fee for Channel 4, then I've got to, my streaming subscription fee for Channel 4, then I've got to have one for ITV, then I've got to have one for BBC, or whatever. Like, it is, you then got that whole thing of, I've got so many different things, streaming services that I'm paying for monthly, and it becomes very, very difficult to track. So I'd love to see, you know, UK TV as one streaming platform, and that could be, you know, we already pay, what is
like
it, 150 quid
or something.
Yeah, exactly. What's the license fee?
164 or something.
164. Yeah, I knew it was over 150 now. Like that a year. Like, if we could pay that and have it as a, they don't have to maybe maintain the broadcast side to the same extent, but it would be a streaming thing instead, because that is what the way that the industry and the actual architecture of the network is moving. Like, that could be a really good option. The only other thing I would like to add as another point is, for me, some of the issue is not necessarily the frequency of the adverts, but the quality of them. And as we're talking about seeing products for things the same time again and again and again on YouTube, I have the opinion that, like, I don't mind seeing adverts. I would like to know that things exist that I want to have. And I've often previously praised Instagram's algorithms in that it's put companies and products towards me that I didn't know existed, didn't know were a thing, and that it sort of learned that I liked like slow fashion and organic materials in clothing, and they plant trees and things when you buy them, that kind of thing. And it put these companies towards me that I just didn't really know exist. I bought things through Instagram ads as a result of this. And I know that's it's a completely different model, but I would like, it would be nice to be able to have more targeted ads using these platforms, rather than you just get the same ones and it's the same, oh, it's just Coors Light again, that thing when there's like a swimmer and he's swimming through snow. It's like, I'm never going to drink that beer. I hate it. So like, there should be a way that if they have your details, they know who you are because it's a streaming platform and you've got an account and you're signed in, that it can be a little bit more potentially targeted, and that would actually show you things that are more relevant, which
it would in a joined up world. In a joined up world, you would have a streaming platform that knew who you were and what you generally liked, in a way that meant that when you watch television live on a smart TV, the ads would be tailored for the person it believes is watching at that point, which is not something that happens now. It's based on the demographic, broad demographics of who tends to watch those sorts of programs. As a slight side note that I wanted to mention, in our live chat, Kate says, I get good targeted ads on Instagram, but Facebook thinks I want to read self-published werewolf porn.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the issues is, I think we could all agree that, like, the advertising world is sort of broken anyway. It is the old way of doing ads on TV is just like their only way of doing sort of market research is, oh, well, we think people who are going to be at home at this time are probably this sort of person, and therefore you get certain ads at different times of day. But it's probably likely that most of it is irrelevant to you, and therefore it's a waste of that advertiser's money in putting adverts in front of people who are not a target for their audience. In the same way, as like when I remember, you know, buying when I bought a bed on the internet, then suddenly I was followed around the internet by beds. It's like, I have just bought a bed. I am now the last person that needs a bed. How about you have a system which is just smart enough to be like, you just bought a bed, how about bedding? What about bedside lamps, other things? But no, more beds. It's like, I am the last person that needs this. I tell the lie, it wasn't a bed, it was a sofa. And I am now the last person that is a thing, or that is a target for your product, because I have just bought one. And I would love for ads to be smart and like, I have this product, and it wouldn't then go, fair enough, we'll show you other relevant things. And I know a lot of people might disagree. It's like, no, I don't want them knowing even more about me. I don't want to know them to know what I own. But if we're going to have ads anyway, which we are, it may as well actually be useful, and it would work. And that could actually save companies money. It might even allow smaller brands to advertise in places, because they are only paying to have it targeted a much smaller subsection of people, which will maybe benefit smaller businesses without the same marketing budget of your Samsungs, etc.
Well, that's been fascinating. And if you have an opinion on the erstwhile fascination, do let us know. hello@uktechshow.com. Coming up, for our patrons listening to our full version of the show, we're going to be talking about the iPhone at 15 years. Can't believe it's been 15 years since the iPhone was released. Well, it has been, and we're going to have a chat about some of the features that it lacked at launch that I had forgotten it lacked at launch. That's coming up. But first, we're going to have a bit of sound, and then we're going to talk about digital photo frames. Did you ever have a digital photo frame, Andy?
Not one that I used or had out of choice. As a journalist, I've been sent a variety.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Yeah, as reviews, and or they just turn up one day. And no, I've never really used them.
I've got 6,000 of them in a box.
Well, same question to Gentleman Two.
Yeah, I have tried them. Because I was given lots of them over the years, and no, never managed to make them stick, frankly.
My question is, where have they all gone?
They're all Amazon Echoes now.
Is that what it is? Because for
maybe.
For
oh, do you mean physically,
there,
or like where has the concept gone? Well, because they're no, all landfill. In landfill. Yeah.
Sadly, that's true. But for a long time there, digital photo frames were a big deal. They were very easy to gift to people at Christmas and birthdays, But they are woefully inefficient ways of displaying photographs. But I wonder, is anyone still buying them?
No. But I do wonder if it's time for a relaunch of photo frames. Because imagine, you could have an OLED panel in there now and it would look really nice.
Interesting. So the one thing that when you say, like when you've used them, I had one a year and a half ago. Netgear do one called the Mural, and M-E-U-R-A-L, and they call it the digital canvas. And it is, I think, 28 inches, and it's in like a really nice frame. So it looks nice. Like art. And it also weighs half a ton, so you've got to like stabilize your wall if you're worried about it. But that is, it is matte finish. It's really high quality, beautiful OLED panel, like really beautiful colors. And it has like a subscription model if you want actual, like really nice art on there. You can buy pieces of, you know, real art, and also from other like modern artists or like historical ones. Or of course, you can put your own stuff in, which for me was great as a photographer. So I just had a variety of photos that it would sort of gently cycle through. That was actually quite nice to have. I mean, it costs an absolute fortune.
How much?
I'm on
the shop now and I can't find a price, which is bad news.
I think they start at like 500 quid, something like that. You know, might be even more. But the older ones that we're talking about are the small, you know, 5x6 ones that would sit on your desk. No, I've never really seen any point of that. The nearest I've got to that is sometimes when I've been using my iPad as a second screen. Sometimes I've just had it playing through photo loops, so it will sort of become a digital photo frame. But there's been no point in having a screen that literally does just that one thing. My iPad then also exists as an iPad when I don't need it to be something else.
They are a relic of an era, a bit like netbooks, I think, and I did do a search for digital photo frames, and although they are still sold, they all resemble very cheap tablet computers, and they are still sold as digital photo frames, and they are anywhere from between about that in the top five that I'm looking at on a popular e-commerce website. They are between £50 and about £130, which seems awfully expensive to me. However, there was a feature that I did used to really like about one digital photo frame that I had, which is that you could remotely send pictures to it, which was ideal if you were wanting to give them to, say, a grandparent, and you could remotely send new photos to it. That was a nice feature. And I don't honestly believe, short of giving someone a tablet and telling them how it works, there is any equivalent that does that job, other than obviously posting them a new photo every month, which I think is a bit of a shame, even though the landfill of the world is very grateful that people aren't buying these in the numbers they were.
The other thing is that if you think about it, you could repurpose a TV into something like this quite easily. Just get a frame. You know, give the measurements to your local framer. They could build you a custom frame.
But that's a hell of a logistical challenge, because that's big and bulky and it requires cabling. And yeah, Samsung sells...
All true.
Don't they?
They sell the frame. Yeah. And actually, it looks really good. I hate to say it in a way. But yeah, if you... that's a very, very popular product line for them, I've always suspected, because people look at it and they go, oh wow, it does art when it's, you know, in standby kind of thing. And my sister's got one and it looks really nice.
Your sister,
but you do have to mount it too high, that's the problem.
Your sister, yeah. Sorry, no, that came across wrong. Your sister's got the Samsung
yeah,
frame.
Oh yeah,
okay, interesting. Oh, I'd be interested in
does look really nice.
But that's purpose built for it, you know, using a very, very modern, expensive TV, which is incredibly thin and therefore allows for wall mounting within a frame like that.
Yeah.
I think trying to retrofit a wooden box frame around, you know, the sort of people you're talking about are likely going to have older TVs. You talk about repurposing an old TV. Therefore, it's probably going to be at least a minimum of 6 inches deep, and trying to
the thing is
wall
that you
mount
can...
that and... Yeah,
you're right, but you could easily take all the bits out of a monitor and build and, you know, a frame that way, I don't think it would be that difficult. I've seen people do it in videos on YouTube. This, you know, the same kind of idea. If you could get a, you could easily talk a framer, I'm sure, into putting a frame on a sort of small wooden box or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You could do. It's just not an average consumer thing, is it? Really?
No, it's not.
Like, even maybe, I couldn't be bothered doing that.
Maybe we could return to the topic at the start of the show and printing emails. Maybe the answer is print out the photograph and stick it on a wall because it'd use a lot less power. And then we can change our email signatures to please think before printing this photograph. That would be the way forward. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because I was in the shower the other day thinking about digital photo frames,
I was just going to say, have you been like transported back to the late 90s or something? Is that what's going on here? Well, maybe 2006 or something.
No. No, it's just what I think about when I'm showering. You know, everyone has their own thoughts. And
the
mine
early
was,
century.
And
Fair
mine
enough.
Was what happened to digital photo frames and how many email signatures annoy me these days. It's just... That's just...
Good job you've got a podcast, really. Otherwise, all this stuff would go unbroadcast.
Yes. Kate in live chat says, if you ever bring a digital photo frame into this house, you can turn around and walk straight back out with it.
I suspect that there are at least two or three digital photo frames in your house, though. In the bottom of one of those drawers, there'll be a digital photo frame. I would put some money on it.
No.
What's in your garage? Is there anything in your garage?
Definitely not. That's a topic for another day. And in fact, it was a topic for an extra message where I unboxed an old box of tech once. And I'll tell you now, there were no digital photo frames in there. But if you listening have a digital photo frame and have a use for it still, genuinely would be quite interested to hear that. More so than some of our listeners in the live room. But Ian and I would be very interested. And Andy might be too. Who knows?
No,
but,
no. Not at all.
We're going to jump into some feedback now because we had a few emails last week in response to our discussion around biometrics, Ian. Very few people, it seems, quite sadly, if I'm honest, seem to think it was a good idea to use one's back passage as a method of biometric authentication. And I can certainly say that in tutoring my mum how to change her password on Google recently and add an additional fingerprint to her Touch ID, it's one that popped to mind that I was very glad does not exist. Anyway, a couple of messages came in on that topic. Raphael wrote in, concerning the ID thingy, if a vending machine would verify your age with a face scan, it would just be as useless and easily fooled by asking somebody else to buy the thing you want for you, just like you ask someone else to purchase alcohol from a shop with regular human cashiers. It's a very good point, and maybe that's why those face ID vending machines have never really caught on. Mike also wrote in, it says, hello, Nate and Ian. One of the problems with biometrics and other possession tokens is that there is no way for the user to withhold it if under duress. If my device solely relied on facial or fingerprint authentication, there is nothing to stop someone forcing me to look at or place my finger on the device and unlock it. Passcodes and passwords, knowledge tokens, he puts in parentheses, can be solely committed to human memory and have to actively be recalled from memory. How many times have we seen situations where a person will not give up a password or safe combination? Knowledge tokens, like passwords, also allow for the possibility of duress, false data, or self-destruct scenarios. If I'm being forced to unlock a device against my will, I could enter a different password to my normal one that could carry out an additional action such as notify a third party I'm under duress, display false information to those forcing me to unlock my device, or destroy that information or device entirely. I thought that was a very informative bit of feedback.
Certainly true. There are biometric authentications that do require, for example, the iPhone has, you need to be looking at it in order for it to unlock. It won't just unlock if you show it your face. That's an optional setting. There are other things you can do with biometrics, like asking people to smile to confirm a purchase, that kind of thing. So I get the point.
People to smile to confirm a purchase.
Yeah,
that's.
Can you imagine doing that under torture?
Does it have to like? Is it that thing where when it then comes back and says, "Sorry, you only smiled with your mouth. You didn't smile with your eye. It didn't look like a real smile. You've got to be really happy." That sounds like that god-awful cafe in LA where in order to order something, you've got to say what you're thankful for and you've got to tell them why you're happy to be there. And I'm like, absolutely not. Give me the goddamn food I'm paying for and leave me alone.
Yeah, I mean, I take the point. But I mean, to say it's not your possible choice to protect it is not quite right.
Well, a very interesting bit of feedback there. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Raphael, and everyone else who wrote in with comments on that. We do read them all. We can't always get to them all. But yes, please keep them coming. Now, it's normal at this point in the show that we check out what's been happening in the wider world of technology news with Mr. Tom Merritt. But we're taking a slightly different track this week. Why, you may ask? And you'd be right to ask it. Tom has the answer.
Hey there, I'm Tom Merritt. I've been podcasting since 2005 about technology and other geeky topics, but I've always wanted to do a talk show. I've been kind of training for this my whole life. Some of my best memories growing up were just talking with my grandpa Carl and my grandma Roxy. So I've decided to start a talk show where I can have a word with interesting people about how they think about things. Because none of us can know everything, but we can share how we try to know enough to get by. So join me for A Word with Tom Merritt. Talk to you soon.
Wonderful.
Great idea. Love the name. I sort of feel that if Tom's starting another podcast, it is time for me to finally start Nate Langston's Magnificent World of Smells.
Mm.
But I also am kind of aware that the crossover there is somewhat similar. So maybe I've possibly missed the boat on that.
Well,
who knows?
Already quite a lot of talk shows. There's probably room for another one.
Well, who knows? Maybe. But check that out. A Word podcast with Tom Merritt there. Hope it does well. Andy, you get to say something now about what you do that is extracurricular. Where can people find you? And thank you for joining us, by the way.
I'll answer that in reverse order. You're welcome. They can find me most of my extracurricular stuff that is relevant or important and that I would like you to go and look at would be my YouTube channel. That is youtube.com/AndrewLangstonPhotography. That probably isn't actually a URL that will work, so maybe just Google Andrew Langston Photography if you are at all interested in the photography that I do out and about in the countryside, in Scotland, it's macro or it's landscapes. It's good times.
It's
good
very
times
relaxing.
With a camera.
It's very relaxing stuff, I have to say. And we'll include a link to Andy's channel in the show notes at uktechshow.com/episodes. Also in the MP3 description if you're listening as well. If you'd like a peaceful jaunt through some countryside with some nice close-ups of snails and other forest paraphernalia, then I strongly recommend it. It's very, very, very fun. And I say that... Go on.
Sorry, I was going to say we've had another podcast rating on iTunes.
Oh, have we?
Yeah.
I did not know this. Please.
This is from the 22nd of May, 2022. Jamanka, I think is how that's pronounced. Discover this gem of a podcast from DTNS. If you're looking for a UK-focused tech podcast with some great banter and music, you've come to the right place. So thanks for that.
Oh, magnificent. Had no idea that was there. Thanks for keeping an eye on that, Ian.
Yeah, I like to check in occasionally.
Marvelous. Well, thank you very much for that. Thank you for everyone who keeps listening, rating us, leaving reviews. It's incredibly helpful. And of course, if you want the full version of the show, do head over to patreon.com/UK Tech. This week, I did an extra message where I discussed, while in a forest spotting deer, how I finally quit a free-to-play game that I've been borderline addicted to for 3 years. So that's out now on the Patreon feed. Andy and Ian, it has been a great pleasure for the most part. And
how does that mean?
Well, I'm always doing the podcast with you and it's great, but I'm related to Andy, so I've got to get the jibes in somewhere.
Fair enough.
Thanks.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.